America has only 4.4% of world's population, only 4.4%, yet 31% of all opioid deaths that we have around the world is from U.S. My guest today is Dr. Chris Johnson, who is an expert speaker on the opioid crisis, public health advocate, author, emergency physician. And every week we talk about who we want to bring up to interview on what topic. This opioid topic came up, you know, oxycodone, and many of us have either had direct experience with it or an indirect experience with it, a loss of a loved one. It's very painful. But one of the statistics I saw went up, there's many different things we're going to get into. One of the statistics I saw him talk about was the fact that America has only 4.4% of world's population, only 4.4%, yet 31% of all opioid deaths that we have around the world is from U.S. So we want to find out why is U.S. This is not a statistic we want to be leading in, and he's the expert in this area. So Dr. Chris Johnson, thank you so much for making the time for being a guest on Vitamin.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, that talk you gave on TED Talks was what you had. Obviously, you have a charisma, you have charm, but the statistics I was looking at, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Why are we not talking about this? So would you mind taking a moment and telling the audience your background? Obviously, I have it here. You garnered the first physician award in 2017. You've spoken to FDA advisory committees. You've spoken to a bunch of different groups. But give us your history and what got you to be wanting to do more research on this specific topic?
Well, as you mentioned, my background is emergency medicine, and I'm a practitioner here in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And it might be a little bit unusual that some would find, like, why is an emergency medicine physician talking about this? Shouldn't we be talking to a pain physician, or should we be talking to addiction physicians? And there certainly are experts in that area too. But what got me motivated to learn more about this was my own clinical practice in the early to mid 2000s, where I was going to work every day. And I found that I really couldn't get through a shift without seeing a patient who was either having some sort of pain exacerbation or complication from opioids, maybe someone overdosing. They needed me to give them either like Narcan, the antidote. Sometimes I'd have to intubate them, put them on a ventilator. But actually, more often than not, it was someone on high dose opioids such as OxyContin plus Percocet, another opioid, a short acting for breakthrough. And they were coming in because they were having breakthrough pain. They were out of their opioids. And I was looking around, I was like, why is this happening? I don't remember this in my medical school training. I don't remember this when I was training as what's called a resident physician, which is an apprentice physician, but it's happening every shift now. And I tried to invest, like, why is this, has it always been like this? Or is this something
new? Are you asking people at that time? Or are you like that?
I'm asking myself. I mean, for the most part, I'll be honest, Mike, most people, like, they're just like, oh, I guess this is what's happening. This is how we're going to practice now. And you just manage it.
Even in your world, pretty wild.
And, you know, who knew how that happened? But I sort of took it the next step, and I investigated, is this different? Or is it just, I've just been unaware and only becoming aware of something that's been going on for years and years.
Yep.
And what I found was that it was in fact very different, that in 1995, the United States was not like this. Yes, you still had problems with opioid addiction. You still had even opioid overdose deaths. Okay. But the country dramatically changed from 1995 to 2005. The prescriptions for opioids massively increased. And with the massive increase in the prescriptions, you had all these patients who now became dependent or had chronic opioid, chronic pain on chronic opioids, and they were having problems with it. And so my research at that time was mostly to investigate, is this real? Is what I am seeing real? And how did it happen? And so that became my motivation, mostly to see, like, what I was seeing every day was not corresponding to what I was taught as a physician in training. That is, these medicines were effective, they were safe, and they had very low abuse potential. And that wasn't what I was seeing every day.
Yeah. What I did is when you started talking, I said, okay, these stats, they don't make any sense to be this staggering. So I went to drugabuse.gov, and this is the stat that came up. This is as recent as 2019, national drug overdose deaths involving any opioids, number of among all ages, gender, 99 to 2019. Great. So in 1999, it's less than 10,000. Okay. Then we go to 21,000 in 2010, but then the dramatic upswing to 49,860. And by the way, this is pre-COVID. So we can't say, well, during COVID, people are sitting around there and there are a lot of different pain. This is not a small trend here. Some people would say this is even at a faster growth than the S&P 500. Not some people would say it's accurate. So what caused this level of growth in Americans taking opioids?
Well, actually, that graph is out of date. If it included the year 2020, that number from 50,000 or just about 50,000 overdose deaths from opioids would be 70,000.
Holy moly.
So while COVID happened, all right, the opioid epidemic got much worse, okay? And so even that graph, as dramatic as it is out of date, and it's even worse now. And if it went back farther from 1999, if it went back to like 1992, there were only about 6,000 deaths per year. And about 4,000 were from prescription, another 2,000 from heroin. And that had been stable going back into the 80s and even the 70s. And then starting in the late 1990s, early 2000s, you saw it go up and up and up. And that corresponds to when the treatment for chronic pain changed and we started prescribing opioids for back pain, for headaches, for arthritis. And we exposed this massive new group in the patient population to opioids, and caused a great many to become dependent or addicted at that time. And then as we started to realize in the 2010s, around 2010, 2015, that prescriptions were the root cause of this increase in dependence and addiction and death, we started to level off the prescribing, but it was too late by then. You had already created this population of people who now needed this. And as their dependence got worse, as their addiction got worse, they turned to things like heroin. So that's starting around the 2015, yep. You see the heroin go up.
Yep.
And then starting in the like 2017, then you have the fentanyl come in. And when you have this population that's dependent and now they are getting, fentanyl from China and other places that have learned to manufacture this stuff and they ship it. And then people who are selling not the medical market, but the extra legal market to these patients who have become dependent from what we did, that's where you have this explosion in overdose deaths, because when they go outside the regular medical marketplace, you don't know what's in it. And that's when you get people might think they're buying oxycodone pills, but they're actually oxycodone pills and there's fentanyl in there. But they didn't, that's the danger. So that's why you have that dramatic increase, even in the last 5 to 8 years of deaths, is because that's where it's coming from. It's coming from the heroin and the illicit fentanyl.
Yeah. So how come we're not, I mean, look, I saw the J&J lawsuit that took place, I think started in 2020, October 13th, and then July 21st. Drug distributors and J&J reached $26 billion deal to end opioids lawsuits. Are you seeing a major progress being made by both doctors? Because you give credit to four reasons why this is taking place, right? It wasn't just let's blame the pharmaceutical companies. It was four different things that you talked about. Are you seeing this being an issue that the folks at the top from the politics or whoever holds them accountable is bringing this up more? Or are they kind of looking the other way from your experience?
My experience is that these settlements that you're talking about, and if you look closely at the settlements, you'll see that how many years that they're paid out over. And it's oftentimes 7 years, sometimes 10 years that they are making these, you know, these restitution payments. OK, but understand that they've made billions and billions on their drugs, and they will continue to sell and make billions while they're making these payments. So it's really just the number sounds big, and you might say, well, it's better than nothing. but it's a good business model. I mean, no executives went to jail and none are going to jail. You know, and the Sacklers, the ones who own Purdue Pharma, they just got a bankruptcy settlement in earlier this month. They are immune to civil litigation for in perpetuity now. They get to keep over their many billions they've made. They get to keep all that, and they never admitted wrongdoing. So fines seems to be what pharmaceutical companies do and is seen as the cost of doing business. And it's a good business decision if you're a pharmaceutical company or if you're a board or a shareholder. Like, yes, you market these drugs. They're not really approved for what you say they're using, but we're making a lot of money. Eventually, someone will impose a fee, but it'll be far less than what we've made. So that's a good business decision. And what I want to point out to you and some of your viewers is that this is not the first time that has happened. Other drugs have had similarly been marketed off-label, and I'm referring to a drug called Neurontin here. It's just a very famous case. Neurontin was marketed by Pfizer as a drug for seizure disorder if the other medicines weren't controlling it. But then it got off-label marketed for everything from headaches to ADHD. And because of that, it got so overprescribed and made billions. And they had to pay fines subsequently as well, several hundred million dollars. But if you're paying $700 million on a drug you made billions per year, that is a good business model. You pay the fine, no executives go to jail, the shareholders are happy. The only people that get harmed are the patients. So,
So I'm looking at this. You said at the arrangement, you're right. Under this agreement, the country's three distributors would make payments of $21 billion over 18 years. Johnson & Johnson would pay $5 billion over 9 years. So it's chump change to these guys. But can you go back to the perpetuity, which means there is no lack of accountability? Can you unpack what that means? When they say it's in perpetuity. So if something happens, if you can unpack that for the rest of us.
What that means is that according to, all right, and I can't claim to be a bankruptcy legal expert, okay? But according to the stories I've read about the bankruptcy filing in the state of New York for Purdue Pharma, the Sacklers have been absolved of wrongdoing and they may not be held accountable for any future civil litigation due to the harm of their product that they caused through exposing them even irresponsibly. And remember that if Purdue Pharma had to pay hundreds of millions back in like 2007 for irresponsible marketing of their product even then. So there's nothing new about the irresponsible marketing they got away with it.
So what it means is that how can they do that though? Who allows them to do that? Are these politicians who are helping them do that? Who allows these contracts to be written in a way where they're protected?
It has to do with how the bankruptcy laws are written, and they are written true by politicians. But remember that politicians are writing these laws that are often made put together by the lobbyists that represent the corporate business interests. So they make the laws very favorable to the business interests.
Sure.
You've got the law in the books, and you're like, hey, we'd like to do something, but this, you know, we can't because here's how it's written now. And I'm like, eh.
Just out of curiosity, wasn't the vaccine also written the same way as well in perpetuity that if something were to happen, there can't be a level of accountability to J&J and Pfizer?
About what?
The vaccine.
Oh, I'll be honest. I don't know. I can't say. I don't know how that was.
I saw that where there's a similar accountability where, you know, if something were to happen, say something, there's a reaction, they can't be held accountable either. It protects them. But I want to go to this one site that gives stats on what else is going on with opioids. Here's mass.gov. 4 out of 5 people who use heroin began by misusing prescription pain medications, similar ones you're talking about, Oxycontin, Vicodin, commonly prescribed pain medications. 1 in 14 reports they've misused or abused a prescription drug at least once. I was asking my peers here right now before we setting up the camera, I said, how many of you guys have lost a friend to opioids? Everybody raised their hand. One of them was a teenager because she just got her hands on it. I said, was it from the doctor or somebody else? No, it was just a teenager. One of her friends gave it to her. She thought it was something else. She took it, boom. She lost her life. Two out of three teens abusing prescription meds say they get them from family or friends. So I'll give you one story of a friend of mine, and this is very close to me. Best friend of mine when I was in LA going to Glendale High School, he started taking Vicodin. And he was getting this Vicodin from a dentist that was selling it to him. And he was selling it for whatever the price was. He started off with one, you know, he's having pain. It's like, man, I'm really having this pain. It went to two, to five. It got to a point where it's taking 10, 20 a day, Vicodins. Obviously, we ended up losing them years ago. And I took him to rehab and it wasn't a good situation. I remember one time we're at a restaurant and he steps out right after we were done with Bible study on a Friday. And I'm trying to get this guy to kind of trying to figure out a way to change. He goes to his car, pulls into his car, and I sneak up on him to see where he's at because I knew when he would roll his, when he would talk. And I see he pulls in to take the Vicodin and I take it out of his hand. I take the pills. I've never heard anybody beg for anything in my life to give to them.